Patriots, and it is Monday, June 14th, and an update to your reality. Just wanted to make sure you still understand that we have a hand puppet acting as a president, that the sleepy back, mattress back Harris is still acting as vice president. Jim Hansen is still running the government with his Muppet Show. And characters like Buttigieg are now being considered to be replaced by Beaker or the chef. But other than that, everything is good. So, we also know that what's also good is what's coming up in Bardsfest. Oh, yes. Yes, yes, yes. 26th to the 29th of August in St. Charles, Missouri. And on the 27th, we're going to have a lot of great things. We're opening with shofars, and it's going to be the greatest revival in the history of humankind. Seriously, not kidding when I say that, not even beginning to exaggerate, and even a little tiny bit. But on the 27th, we're also having Mike Lindell speak, which is a big deal. And as part of that, we're celebrating the slipper revolution, which means what? You need to get yourself a pair of my slippers. You can bring your my pillow if you want, though I think it's going to be hard to carry that around all day. But my slippers for sure. And then we're going to celebrate Mike Lindell, the greatest CEO in America, by all of us putting on a pair of my slippers and doing my slipper happy dance revolution. And then when you go outside, you can slipper slap some fools that don't understand. But that's my slipper revolution. So what do you need for that? You need to get over to MyPillow and you need to get yourself a pair of my slippers. And you need to get yourself a whole bunch of other stuff like my towels and my doggy beds and my pillows. My pillows are on sale too right now, 66% off. And my slippers are 40% off. And you use the Bards code, B-A-R-D-S, B-A-R-D-S. That's your promo code for all those great savings. Just go to myslipper.com. You can also call the 800 number, 800-975-2939, 800-975-2939, to talk to a real person. And if you're doubting what type of great company MyPillow is, they've already contributed over $20,000 to the Bards Fest. I just think that's fantastic. So get on over there and support America's greatest company, America's greatest CEO, with some great products, some things you're not going to be unhappy with, a comfy MyPillow, some comfy MySheets under a comfy MyComforter. And you get up and you slip your feet into your comfy my slippers, and away you go. Cup of coffee in hand, and you're ready to rock and roll. All right, Patriots, so MyPillow.com, Bards, B-A-R-D-S is your promo code. And that number, if you want to talk to a real person, is 800-975-2939. Rock and roll. Sounds like a good morning to me. So I read this in the previous show, and I just want to make sure that those of you that are tuning in do get to hear it. It's a pretty interesting perspective piece from the website greatawakening.win. And I'll just read this perspective very quickly. Something a lot of people are missing in this whole Arizona audit thing. The Dems will try and say the Arizona, when Arizona is decertified, that Sheedon, also known as hand puppet Biden, will still have it. Still has enough electoral votes, so it doesn't matter, except it does in a big way, because the part everyone is missing is Trump still has not conceded the election. It is very important for what comes next. You see, if Arizona decertifies the results, the entire election is now in question. Congress cannot certify until all states have certified. Just like a state cannot certify unless 100% of their counties certify, the same is true of a national election with the states themselves. As Trump hasn't conceded, he now has a right to contest the entire election, and that will mean the remaining 49 states will have to conduct a full forensic audit as well. Why do you think so many states are visiting Arizona for the audit right now, including states that supposedly already went Trump and didn't have contested election issues? They know what is coming. They know what is coming. Do you all remember prior to 2018 election, Trump signed an EO making national elections a matter of national security? Now put two and two together. Even if one state shows fraud, it calls into question the results of the entire election. Being a matter of national security now puts it under the purview of who, as forensic audits are done state by state. If you answer the military, you are on the right track. Now the states will try to claim that it is state sovereignty and the feds cannot do that. However, for anyone who has read, and he's referring to his previous articles, Storm Series, the military is not federal. It belongs to the individual states, as that is where the citizens in the military are derived from. Therefore, the state being part of the U.S. means the military in each state may take over. True, citizen soldiers from Texas, for example, could not oversee the audit in Michigan, but the military would be able to oversee it just fine. There will be states that will take this up on their own to avoid the military. There will be states that will resist. However, as Trump warned them before certifying the results, the legislatures in states that resist and refuse to do audits will now find themselves embroiled in accessory to fraud once the audits are done. But you see, here is where it gets good. Once the election is on hold, while results are determined, it means that the current fraud president, that would be hand puppet Biden, is technically not holding office. He's not anyway. But neither is former president, is President Trump, who is actually the real president. So who gets to run things while this all gets sorted out? How do you introduce all military evidence they collected in the sting? Why you have the military legally engaged in a national security issue, and then you turn up with the evidence of foreign involvement. As I previously said in the Storm series, this is why you only need one state to turn up fraud. I hope now more understand why. Either the states are going to band together and fix this defiance of the federal government since it calls into question legitimacy of the entire government, or the military is going to take over per the law of war manual until this is sorted out. It is going to be a very, very hot summer. And today is Flag Day, and today is the end of the Arizona audit day, and dun-dun-dun-dun, today is President Trump's birthday. So that just seems to me like that's three booms. And it sounds to me like we're into an epic week. And as it turns out, tomorrow here in Oregon begins 10 days of very hot summer weather. So just thought I'd mention that. Kind of an interesting time we sit in, isn't it, Patriots? So here we go. We're going to read today Federalist Paper number 70, and which just happens to be more about the executive branch. Always amazed at the timing of things. We started this thing back in January. I think that's when we began this. Maybe earlier. December, maybe. You never know where you're going to land. There was no way of knowing because we were moving between the daily commentaries that I enjoy giving and the Federalist Paper. And here we arrive on Federalist Paper number 70, the Executive Department Further Considered, which just seems very apropos considering the State of the Union and the crisis in the presidential arm. Almost like God guided this perfectly. Amazing. So here we go. By the way, Kennedy was our 35th president. It's kind of interesting, too. Because today is 2 times 35, which is 70. That's kind of funny. I'm sure that's just a coincidence. We know how that goes. All right, Patriots, the Executive Department Further Considered is the title of this article from the New York Packet, Tuesday, March 18, 1788. Author is Alexander Hamilton. To the people of the state of New York, there is an idea, which is not without advocates, that a vigorous executive is inconsistent with the genius of Republican government. The enlightened well-wishers to this species of government must at least hope that the supposition is destitute of foundation. since they can never admit its truth without at the same time admitting their condemnation of their own principles. Energy in the executive is a leading character in the definition of good government. It is essential to the protection of the community against foreign attacks. It is not less essential to the steady administration of the laws, to the protection of property against those irregular and high-handed combinations which sometimes interrupt the ordinary course of justice, to the security of liberty against the enterprises and assaults of ambition, of faction, and of anarchy. Every man, the least conversant in Roman story, knows how often the Republic was obliged to take refuge in the absolute power of a single man, under the formidable title of dictator, as well as against the intrigues of ambitious individuals who aspired to the tyranny, and the seditions of whole classes of the community whose conduct threatened the existence of all government, as against the invasions of external enemies who menaced the conquest of the destruction of Rome. Well, in that one sentence, patriots, our founding fathers just spoke of this current time in history. Enemies foreign and enemies domestic. Continuing, there can be no need, however, to multiply arguments or examples on this head. A feeble executive implies a feeble execution of the government. A feeble execution is but another phrase for a bad execution, and a government ill executed, whatever it may be in theory, must in practice be a bad government. Taking it for granted, therefore, that all men of sense will agree in the necessity of an energetic executive, it will only remain to inquire where all the ingredients which constitute this energy, how far can they be combined with those other ingredients which constitute safety to the Republican sense, and how far does this combination characterize the plan which has been reported by the convention? The ingredients which constitute energy in the executive are, first, unity, secondly, duration, thirdly, an adequate provision for its support, fourthly, competent powers. Now, I just want to point out that in two previous paragraphs back, what was pointed out is the feeble government. Right now, what we are witnessing is a feeble government, a government that has no legs, no power, no nothing. And you'll notice why that's happening, because there is a feeble executive. Because the entire idea of this coup was to create a feeble executive so that ultimately the government of the United States would be so feeble that foreign powers would be able to get control of the United States and then roll us into a one-world global technocracy run by corporate techno powers and banking elites, also known as the NWO, facilitated with their primary agenda, which was fake climate change nonsense, fake climate change science, and a new god, all driven by human 2.0, which is transhumanism. So there's your whole package. If you don't believe it, look around. Oh, and if you have questions about it, I think you can go get a free donut and get your shot, and you can join the army of the transhumans. Just an idea. Continuing, the ingredients which constitute safety in the Republican sense are, first, a due dependence on the people, secondly, a due responsibility. Those politicians and statesmen who have been the most celebrated for the soundness of their principles and for their justice of their views have declared in favor of a single executive and a numerous legislature. They have with great propriety considered energy as the most necessary qualification of the former, and have regarded this a most applicable to power in a single hand, while they have with equal propriety considered the latter as best adapted to deliberation and wisdom. That's interesting. We just did wisdom earlier in previous show. Nice word. And best calculated to conciliate the confidence of the people and to secure the privileges and interests. That unity is conducive to energy will not be disputed. Decision, activity, secrecy, and dispatch will generally characterize the proceedings of one man in a much more eminent degree than the proceedings of any greater number. And the proportion as the number is increased, these qualities will be diminished. This unity may be destroyed in two ways, either by vesting the power in two or more magistrates of equal dignity and authority, or by vesting it ostensibly in one man, subject in whole or in part to control or cooperation of others in the capacity of counselors to him. Of the first, the two councils of Rome may serve as an example. Of the last, we shall find examples in the constitutions of several of the states. New York and New Jersey, if I recollect right, are the only states which have instructed the executive authority wholly in a single man. But these methods of destroying the unity of the executive have their partisans. But their votaries are an executive council are the most numerous. They are both liable, if not to equal, to similar objections and may in most lights be examined in conjunction. Now remember, patriots, this was a time of debate of the new Constitution. And listening to the debates around that time, we are aware that there was discussion of whether to have a single executive or to have it be a shared executive or a council of wise men, so to speak. And so you've already heard the reference, which our founding fathers are so deeply read in the history of what we would call the ancient histories, ancient Rome, and all of the failures and challenges that were faced by those forms of governance. So, this here is an example of this discussion that we're going to continue. The experience of other nations will afford little instruction on the head. As far, however, as it teaches anything, it teaches us not to be enamored of plurality and executive. We have seen that the Achaeans, on an experiment of two praetors, were induced to abolish one. The Roman history records many instances of mischiefs to the Republic from the dissensions between the councils or consuls and between the military tribunes, which were at times substituted for the consuls. But it gives us no specimens of any peculiar advantage derived but to the state from the circumstances of the plurality of those magistrates, that the dissensions between them were not more frequent or more fatal, in a matter of astonishment, until we advert to a singular position in which the Republic was almost continually replaced, and to the prudent policy pointed out by the circumstances of the state, pursued by the consuls, of making a division of the government between them. The partisans engaged in a perpetual struggle with the plebeians for the presentation of their ancient authorities and dignities. The consuls were generally chosen out of the former body, were commonly united by the personal interest they had in the defense of the privileges of their order. In addition to this motive of a union, after the arms of the Republic were considerably expanded the bounds of its empire, it became an established custom with the consuls to divide the administration between themselves by a lot, one of them remaining at Rome to govern the city and its environs, to the other taking the command to the more distant provinces. This expedient must, no doubt, have had great influence in preventing those collusions and rivalships which might otherwise have embroiled in peace of the Republic. So just a quick piece on that to clarify. The plebeians is the council of the people, and the consuls was the leadership group that oversaw Rome, and they were elected, the consuls were elected from the plebeians, and in later years, the consuls that came together were then divided up so that there wasn't a consul all in one place, but they put them out to their outer regions to rule together. So essentially what they did is they turned consul, which was a group, into an executive single person in Rome, and they used their body of consuls spread out among the territories of Rome so that each territory ended up with a representative of the consul, which was effectively the same as having a president in each consul. But only difference is a president that wasn't elected by the people but was representative of the people. And so the debate right now in this The debate that's going on right now in this discussion is the debate of whether we should have a single executive, a shared executive, like a dual magistrate, or a consul like Rome. And the argument is showing that there really isn't any benefit to consul. In fact, putting consuls together leads to potential rivalries and people seeking to outwit the other. You create more problems than you solve. But quitting the dim light of historical research, attaching ourselves purely to the dictates of reason and good sense, we shall discover much greater cause to reject than to approve the idea of plurality in the executive under any modification whatsoever. Those two words, patriots, reason and good sense, would be great words to get back in our country again today, because they are missing in our dialogue, in our existence. Hence the million plus it took the injection. No reason and no common sense. Man. Or good sense, for that matter. Continuing. Wherever two or more persons are engaged in a common enterprise or pursuit, there is always danger of difference of opinion. If it be a public trust or office, in which they are clothed with equal dignity and authority, there is peculiar danger of personal emulation and even animosity. From either, and especially from all these causes, the most bitter dissensions are apt to spring. Whenever these happen, they lessen the respectability, weaken the authority, and distract the plans and operations of those whom they divide. If they should unfortunately assail the supreme executive magistracy of a county consisting of a plurality of persons, this might impede or frustrate the most important measures of the government in the most critical emergencies of the state. And what is still worse, they might split the community into the most violent and irreconcilable factions, adhering differently to the different individuals who composed the magistracy. Men often oppose a thing merely because they have no agency in planning it, or because they may have been planned by those whom they dislike. But if they have been consulted and have happened to disapprove, opposition then becomes, in their estimation, an indispensable duty of self-love. They seem to think themselves bound to honor, and by all the motives of personal infallibility, to defeat the success of what has been resolved upon contrary to their sentiments. Men of upright, benevolent tempers have too many opportunities of remarking with horror to what desperate lengths the disposition of some is sometimes carried, and how often the great interests of society are sacrificed to the vanity, to the conceit, and to the obstinacy of individuals who have credit enough to make their passions and their caprices interesting to mankind. Perhaps the question now before the public may, in its consequences, afford melancholy proofs of the efforts of this despicable frailty, or rather detestable vice in the human character. That last peace would require people to be accountable. It sounds like even then they had to force people to be accountable to their actions and be aware of it. Continuing, upon the principles of free government, inconveniences from the source just mentioned must necessarily be submitted to the formation of the legislature, but it is unnecessary and therefore unwise to introduce them into the constitution of the executive. It is here too many, too, that they may be most pernicious. In the legislature, promptitude of decision is oftener an evil than a benefit. The differences of opinion and the jarrings of parties in the department of the government, though they may sometimes obstruct statutory plans, yet often promote deliberation and circumspection and serve to check excesses in the majority. When a resolution two is once taken, the opposition must be at an end. That resolution is a law, and a resistance to it punishable. But no favorable circumstances palliate or atone to the disadvantages of dissension in the executive department. Here they are pure and unmixed. There is no point at which they cease to operate. They serve to embarrass and weaken the executive of the plan or measure which they relate from the first step to the final conclusion. They constantly counterattack those qualities in the executive which are the most necessary ingredients in its composition, vigor, and expedition, and that without any counterbalancing good. In the conduct of war, in which the energy of the executive is the bulwark of the national security, everything would be to be apprehended from its plurality. Okay, there's a couple of key things there worth mentioning. We're discussing the frailty of the executive if you start to make it a plural office, meaning one or more than one person. And we're noticing that, and what they're pointing out is that as legislatures debate things and make law, the last thing you want to do is then pass that on to an executive council or consul, as the Romans would call it, in which they would be debating the outcome of a law that was passed by the legislative branch. The executive needs to be pure in its thought. It needs to be aligned in its thinking. Now, what we have witnessed under President Trump is that you had a strong executive head, the president, surrounded by traitors that were constantly backstabbing him through leaks and other elements. And so we didn't have a pure executive council. What we had was very much Romanesque, which was a consul of people, not really people. There's a donkey's backside would be a better term for that. And who were stabbing the executive and the will of the people in the back. Understand that. These people would have carried knives if they thought they could get away with it. And that's who was surrounding POTUS the entire time. Oh, a little footnote here for you. Every one of POTUS's faith leaders, supports the injection, and at one point or another has closed their churches. Just thought I'd mention that. That's the traitors and treason that surrounded our executive. Continuing, it must be confessed that the observations apply with principal weight to the first case, supposed that is to the plurality of magistrates of equal dignity and authority, a scheme that the advocates for which are not likely to form numerous sect, but they reply, though not with equal, yet with considerable weight to the project of council, whose concurrence is made constitutionally necessary to the operations of the ostensible executive. That translates to, the observations made have been towards those of deceit in councils, that there are such things as benevolent councils, but in the end they succumb to the wills of men and they will be corruptible. Continuing, an artful cabal in that council would be able to distract and to enervate the whole system of administration. If no such cabal should exist, the mere diversity of views and opinions would alone be sufficient to tincture the exercise of executive authority with a spirit of habitual feebleness and dilatoriness. But one of the weightiest objections to plurality in the executive, and which lies as much against the last as the first plan, is that it tends to conceal faults and destroys responsibility. Responsibility of two kinds, to censor and to punishment. The first is more important than the two, especially in the elective office. Man in public trust will much oftener act in such a manner as to render him unworthy of being any longer trusted than in such a manner as to make him obnoxious to legal punishment. But the multiplication of the executive adds to the difficulty of detection in either case. It often becomes impossible amidst mutual accusations to determine on whom the blame or the punishment of a pernicious measure or a series of pernicious measures ought really to fall. It is shifted from one to the other with such dexterity and under such plausible appearance that the public opinion is left in suspense about the real author. The circumstances which may have led to any national miscarriage or misfortune are sometimes so complicated that where there are a number of actors who may have had different degrees or kinds of agency, though we may clearly see upon the whole that there has been mismanagement, yet it may be impractical to pronounce to whose account the evil may have been incurred is truly chargeable. Meaning if you have a council of people, there's no accountability to the one. Very much what the socialists like to do. They like to spread it around everybody so they can hide within the crowd. Oh, our university system is so good at that too, and teaching children how to be deceitful. I was overruled by my council. The council were so divided in their opinions that it is impossible to obtain their resolution at one point. That's a quote. These and similar pretexts are constantly at hand, whether true or false, and who is there that will either take the trouble or incur the odium of a strict scrutiny in the secret springs of the transaction? Should there be found a citizen zealous enough to undertake the unpromising task, if there happens to be a collusion between the parties concerned, how easy is it to clothe the circumstances with so much ambiguity as to render it uncertain what was the precise conduct of any of these parties? In other words, when you remove accountability, people can hide within the crowd and they can keep the crime from being seen by the public. It's become so convoluted that they'll be able to hide behind the lies. That is exactly what Congress has done over and over, and what our current legislative branch is composed of primarily, which is a bunch of deceitful turds. Turds is an official political term, if you're curious, of deception and deceit. I think it's in the manual of war. You can dig deep and find it. In a single instance in which the governor of the state is coupled with the council that is in appointment to the offices, we have seen the mischiefs of it in the view of new, now under consideration. Scandalous appointments to important offices have been made. Some cases, indeed, have been so flagrant that all parties have agreed to the impropriety of the thing. When inquiry has been made, the blame has been laid by the government on the members of the council who, on their part, have charged it upon his nomination, while the people remain altogether at a loss to determine by whose influence their interests have been committed to the hands of so unqualified and so manifestly improper. In tenderness to the individuals, I forbear the deceit to descend to the particulars. It is, in other words, what happens in this is this is why bodies of legislatures are dangerous, because you'll notice that they'll point the blame at a council, but the council's not an individual and there's no accountability to the council. So you'll say, for example, we need to have a hearing to investigate the council. Okay, and then what? Well, we've determined that the council was out of order. And then they find the scapegoat, whatever that scapegoat is, like the political opponent that they don't like, and they throw some blame on them without having to blame the council, and they just kind of do a quiet censor. And the public never knows truth. And after enough of this dumbing down of the public, the public just begins to give up because there's never any accountability or justice. And that's exactly where we are. This whole discussion here is about the vulnerabilities of councils, and particularly focused on the executive, but also applicable to every other aspect of government. It is evident from these considerations that the plurality of the executive tends to deprive the people of two greatest securities they can have for their faithful exercise of any delegated power. First, the restraints of public opinion, which lose their efficacy, as well as the account of the division of the censor attendant on bad measure among a number, as well as account for the uncertainty on whom it ought to fail. And secondly, the opportunity of discovering with facility and clearness the misconduct of the persons who they trust in order to either their removal from office or their actual punishment in cases which admit of it. In England, the king is a perpetual magistrate, and it is a maximum which has obtained for the sake of the public peace that he is unaccountable for his administration and his person sacred. Nothing, therefore, can be wiser in that kingdom than the annex to the king a constitutional council, who may be responsible to the nation for the advice they give. Without this, there would be no responsibility whatever in the executive department, any idea inadmissible in a free government. But even there, the king is not bound by the resolutions of the council. Though they are answerable for the advice they give, he is the absolute master of his own conduct in the exercise of his office and may observe or disregard the counsel given him at his sole discretion. But in a republic where every magistrate ought to be personally responsible for his behavior in office, the reason which in the British Constitution dictates the propriety of a council not only ceases to apply, but turns against the institution. In a monarchy of Great Britain, it furnishes a substitute for the prohibited responsibility of the chief magistrate, which serves in some degree as a hostage to the national justice for his good behavior. In the American Republic, it would serve to destroy or would greatly diminish the intended and necessary responsibility of the chief magistrate himself. The idea of a council to the executive, which has so generally obtained in the state constitutions, has been derived from the maxim of republican jealousy, which considers power as safer in the hands of a number of men than a single man. If the maxim should be admitted to be applicable to the case, it should contend that the advantage on that side would not counterbalance the numerous disadvantages of the opposite side. But I do not think the rule at all applicable to the executive power. I clearly concur in the opinion this particular with a writer whom the celebrated Junius pronounces to be deep, solid, and ingenious, that, quote, the executive power is more easily confined with it in one, that it is far more safe there should be a single object for the jealousy and watchfulness of the people, and in a word, that all multiplication of the executive is rather dangerous than friendly to liberty. Meaning that if you start to disperse the power of the executive over a number of people, as we've already discussed, they can bury responsibility and accountability to the people, and ultimately, there isn't a single point of accountability for the nation. That's the point of the executive, or what they would call the chief magistrate, or what we call the president. A little consideration will satisfy us that the species of a security sought for the multiplication of the executive is attainable. Numbers must be so great as to render a combination difficult, or that are rather a source of danger than of security. The united credit and influence of several individuals must be more formidable to liberty than the credit and influence of either of them separately. When power, therefore, is placed in the hands of so small a number of men as to admit their interests and views being easily combined in a common enterprise by an artful leader, it becomes more liable to abuse and more dangerous when abused than if it be lodged in the hands of one man. For, from the very circumstance of his being alone, will be more narrowly watched and more readily suspected, and who cannot unite so great mass of influences as when he is associated with others. Decemvirs of Rome, whose name denotes their number, were more than dreaded in their usurpation than any one of them would have been. No person would think of proposition an executive much more numerous than the body. From 6 to 12 have been suggested for the number of the council. The extreme of these numbers is not too great for an easy combination. For such a combination, America would have more to fear than the ambition of any single individual. A council to a magistrate who is himself responsible for what he does are generally nothing better than a clog upon his good intentions. Are often the instruments and accomplice of his bad, and are almost always a cloak to his faults. Meaning that when you put a group of people together as a council, you are almost assured that they're going to be something they're going to be hiding from the public eye, that they can do so better by playing off of each other and keeping people from seeing the transparency of truth in the individual. Last paragraph. I forbear to dwell upon the subject of expense, though it be evident that if the council should be numerous enough to answer the principal end aimed at the institution, the salaries of the members who must be drawn from their homes to reside at the seats of government would form an item of catalog of public expenditures too serious to be incurred for an object of equivocal utility. I will only add that prior to the appearance of the Constitution, I rarely met with an intelligent man from the states who did not admit, as a result of experience, that the unity of the executive of the state was one of the best of distinguishing features of our Constitution. Publius. End of Publius number 7, of Federalist Paper number 70. Right now, we exist in a strange state considering this article, this paper, number 70. We have two presidents at this point in time, and we have some sort of invisible hand keeping this government together, probably FEMA. The issue at hand is that we don't have a country that's truly functioning at this point in time. The executive is power, since it is an executive that was confirmed without all the states confirming the vote, only has legal jurisdiction at the distance of a 13-mile district, a 13-square-mile district known as the District of Columbia. That's the extent of his power. So one asks then is, why is it that he's able to get things affected across the nation? Because these agencies, which exist within that realm, are choosing to abide to his power within the realm of the 13 square miles, and therefore conspire to bring his agenda into the nation by extending that reach by proxy to their remote contacts across the states. This territory, this district, is not even part of the United States as a whole. It's not a state. It has no voting right. It is just a separate little entity that was created in the act. Its true power was given in the act of 1871, and its alliances and allegiances have always been to Rome. One of the reasons that you see them desperately trying to turn it into being a 51st state is not because of votes. It's because this corporation that they're in is bankrupt and has no power. It doesn't exist in the United States. It therefore can be cut off from the United States, isolated, and left to die on its own and wither, which we all hope will happen. It is my true hope that we never return to D.C. as a nation. It's my true hope that we wrap that sewer with a wall and fill it with water and let everything in it drown like rats. It's my hope that that remains a memorial for generations to come of what happens when government runs amok and runs out of control. This whole paper here, Federalist Paper number 70, while focused on the executive and the importance of having a single head in the executive, which we can see witnessed right now, our nation is divided. One president who's taken up residence in Mar-a-Lago, the other president who is a hand puppet, fake Biden, who tries to act like a president, stuck in a 13-square-mile area. So there we have it. So we have two presidents. And you can see what happens in a nation. Imagine having a co-counsel as a president. Imagining of having a multi-person counsel. When you begin to have infighting, each one would grab their constituent areas and they would use them to fight one another, and we would end up with like warring kingdoms. Our founding fathers were very aware of this, and their insight was prescient. They understood exactly what needed to happen to secure the best possible route of success for the United States, and that was to have a single person as executive who would unite the country, or at least function as the single point of success or failure of the nation. In the days, weeks, and months ahead, our nation needs to reclaim its place as a country with one president. There needs to be the accountability to the election and accountability to the vote, to the person. No more of this nonsense of accepting things that are counted by machines or in clouds. For us to restore the Constitution and the validity of the nation, we have to have a valid vote. And for us to restore this nation, people need to start to take accountability for their actions and be participant citizens in a republic. That means not being blind, obedient slaves to fear and the media. That means starting to be awake. That means starting to be accountable. That means putting God in your heart for wisdom. And it means accepting the responsibility of actions taken, such as taking an injection, which will ultimately lead to the transition to transhuman, and being accountable for those decisions that each person took because no one forced them to take it. They did it on their own free will, even though blinded by fear. Even with all of this said, our greatest challenges are still lie ahead. We are at a crossroads in humanity, a crossroads for civilization as a whole. And the road is divided into two lines. One takes you to the future of transhumanism, a dystopian world in which all thoughts, all actions are integrated into a master AI, which provides your sense of consciousness and your allegiance to an artificial God. The other road leads to one rooted in faith and spirit, the relationship of through Christ to God, to Father. That road is a road that we empower the organic nature of being human. We use reason. We use our own free will. We learn to grow deeper into our relationship to God, to expand out our spiritual nature of who we are, to use our understanding of technology to, and our desire to create, but to always put our spirit and a relationship with God first, not backseat. The world of transhumanism and humanism cannot coexist. They are mutually exclusive, not inclusive. And therefore, we face a significant rift in our days, months, and years ahead. The only way we are going to accomplish this fight, ultimately, is to awaken people into this place of accountability. That each person must become their own executive of their life. They can't hide behind the crowd and be a sheep in amongst people, simply saying that they needed to do something because they were afraid of not being included or prioritizing their life in terms of material wants and desires. They have to come to a place of accepting their role as a participant in an experiment that's greater than them, a country that was blessed by God, a country that sits and exists under the structure of moral law. And in so doing, they must be accountable to their daily actions as executives of their life. As our president is accountable to the nation, we each are accountable to the Constitution and to the overseeing of government as a government of we the people. Let us pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this time that we come together. We are blessed by the opportunity to discuss and to explore the deep wisdom that is passed to us and passed from our framers and given to us through our heart with all that you give us in each and every day. May we find that wisdom to guide us. May that wisdom awaken us. May that wisdom guide us in all that we do and all that we engage, to awaken the many that still walk in darkness and who have forgotten their role as being participants in a society where each is an executive, responsible and accountable to the Constitution and to you, and that each of our government officials are accountable to us and accountable to you. Let us never forget the power of a country built on the formation and the will of we the people, always accountable to our God Almighty. In the name of Christ Jesus, amen. So, patriots, we have a lot of work to do and a lot of work ahead. Understanding our past, understanding the intent of the framers, is a critical component to understanding victory in the future. Let us continue to learn, let us continue to dig, let us continue to awaken to the responsibilities that each of us have. So keep your head up and your eyes forward. Never bow to evil. Never relent. Always press into the fight. Prayers up. Keep your knowledge flowing. Dig deep. God is with us. He'll never forsake us. And as always, and as we know, God will always win. Let us be there with him at that victory line. I'll see you this evening for Bards FM. Until then, or until the next time, God bless, and out for now.
We shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe, to assure the survival and the success of liberty.
Every thoughtful citizen who despairs of war and wishes to bring peace should begin by looking inward, by examining his own attitude towards the possibilities of peace. Too many of us think it is impossible. Too many think it is unreal. But that is a dangerous, defeatist belief. It leads to the conclusion that war is inevitable, that mankind is doomed, that we are gripped by forces we cannot control. We need not accept that view. Our problems are man-made, therefore they can be solved by man, and man can be as big as he wants. No problem of human destiny is beyond human beings. Man's reason and spirit have often solved the seemingly unsolvable, and we believe they can do it again. Surely the opening vistas of space promise high costs and hardships, as well as high reward. So it is not surprising that some would have us stay where we are a little longer, to rest, to wait. But this city of Houston, this state of Texas, this country of the United States was not built by those who waited and rested and wished to look behind them. This country was conquered by those who move forward, and so will space. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept.
The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Has waited thousands of years to show its face. It has only one intent, to destroy God's light and to enslave. It has no scruples. It has no rules but one, to win at any cost. But we will never bow, for we are the remnant that will hold the line. This is war. We fight. We push. We climb. We never give in. We become the nightmare that evil didn't know could exist. We pray. We stand. We live by the words, "In God we trust." We fear nothing. We are the light that can never be extinguished. We are patriots. We are the digital army that will help deliver God's wrath.